All right, here we go. Jagamonkey, how are you, sir?
I'm fucking doing fantastic, brother. How you doing?
Fantastic. Yeah, you know, that F-bomb just reminded me this is a 18 and over show. So,
Warning.
How are you? Night of the Living Dreads. I'm Otis B. Dreads, as you can see right over there. And, of course, Jagamonkey there. And we have another pretty kick-ass show. We are, of course, over there at Scurryface, facebook.com/Scurryface. Visit them over there. That's where you can see this, as well as you can go over there and visit them at scurryface.com. And, of course, nightofthelivingdreads.com. Dreads with no A if you haven't been paying attention. We have we got a good one. I'm really, you know, excited for this one. I didn't realize, talking with our guests just before we went live here, I didn't realize that there were, you know, from what I'm gathering, maybe at least a handful of Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan films. Everybody has seen, you know, the Friday the 13th going around. That's probably the most prevalent one that I think hits people's eyes. There's also been handful of the Halloween going out there. And I'm sure there's been others that I just didn't come across. But I was actually surprised that there were as many, because I was under the impression there wasn't any. I really was. I felt like an idiot. But there is. There's at least, you know, a handful. And so if you are a Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan, or a fan of indie horror, or a fan of fan films, if you answered yes to any of those, we got a show for you. If you answered yes to all three, well, pull up a chair. And let us just dive right into it. Let's get into it. And I was wondering, how I have like three little clips before I bring our guest, Mr. Steve Merlo, on. He's up north. He's in our neighbor up north, Western Canada. I think it's the first Canadian guest that we've had on. I don't know. I haven't really been keeping track of nationalities, but it seems
probably.
So anyway, I don't know where that's going. Anyway, let's just bring, you know, Steve in and let's get this going. Steve, how are you, sir?
Oh, just wonderful. How are you guys doing?
Hey, man, we're doing great. How's the weather up north there? I mentioned you're in Western Canada. How's the weather up there? Probably stays fairly chilly anyway, doesn't it?
not where I am. Actually, we're kind of looked at as like the California of Canada. But, I mean, it still does get cold in the winter here. Right now, it's kind of a dreary day, but for the most part, the weather has been not too bad.
Seasonal for that area, then?
Pretty normal for the most part. We've had one snowfall. It was a pretty small snowfall that we had about a week ago. Nothing too major. I imagine we'll get snow pretty soon, though, as we head into December. I imagine we'll get snow pretty soon.
Yeah, we usually get, at least where I'm in Ohio, and we usually get ours right around January-ish. You know, unless it's really unseasonal, and, you know, we've had snow on Halloween before, you know. And
yeah, so, we have too.
Yeah, you never know. Thank you for joining us, by the way.
Thanks for having me.
Man, I have not, and as I mentioned before we brought you on, we were talking just, you know, a little bit about Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan films. I was completely unaware that there were, and you said, well, yeah, there's shit, they're out there. You know, there's a few here, a few there. I mean, I had never seen one.
They're just not as prevalent as like the Friday the 13th ones, like you were saying.
And I think that's probably what it does boil down to. You see more of the Friday the 13th. So are you, let's, I want to get right into, cause we're going to kind of mix this up between the, your fan film called The Sawyer Massacre. And we'll get into some of the things we don't want to spoil it yet, because you're looking at maybe a release, you know, sometime maybe in the fall of next year, is what you're hoping for anyway. So
definitely,
you don't want to give too much out, but you were obviously a Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan.
Yeah, the original is my favorite horror film of all time.
And so is that what kind of propelled you to do a fan film of this? Or was it something, because I think you had mentioned one of the Texas Chainsaw Massacres kind of got you, you know, wanting to pursue this. Which one was that again? Was three the remake in 2000?
The remake, yes. It was the remake from 2003. Which ultimately I can't say I'm a huge fan of. It's one of those movies I've come back to many, many times trying to like it more. but to me, there's just too many issues with it that it's probably still my second favorite in the franchise. But there's a lot of things that really bug me about that. But at the same time, there's also a lot of things I really like about it, particularly the beginning of the film. With all the crime scene walkthrough stuff, all that black and white footage and John Larroquette's narration, I thought that was great. This was setting the movie up to be a fantastic fan, maybe even better than the original, I was thinking at the time. Of course, I was 23 and didn't know any better, but yeah, I just thought the setup was so great that the payoff just wasn't quite there for me, and it just began. You know, I just started getting ideas. It was just started off with, well, I would have done this.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, you're probably starting, you know, picking, because where were you directing? When did you get into the whole filmmaking process? You know, was that a long time before this? So you were able to pick it with a director, filmmaker type brain? Was that what was going on then?
Definitely not, actually. I mean, I wasn't. Really? I think at that time I was not as analytical. I didn't get into filmmaking till it was probably nearly 10 years after I had seen that film. So, I mean, when I watched it, it was one of those things where I kept wondering why I didn't like this. And, you know, what is it about Leatherface in this movie that I don't like? I just know that I don't really care for the way he looks and acts. It just doesn't feel like Leatherface. Mm-hmm. And I think once I actually became a director, and actually got into filmmaking, then I could kind of look at it and say, this is actually why it doesn't work for me. Now I know why it doesn't work for me. Whereas back then I just knew I didn't like certain aspects of it. I knew that certain aspects didn't feel right in that film to me, but I didn't know why. And I think becoming a filmmaker allowed me to see those much more clearly.
Oh, absolutely. Jackal Monkey, you being, we were talking before you joined us, you know, while we were waiting for you to join us, talking about your first film endeavor and, you know, writing the script. I'm sure you want to pick Steve's brain, being, you know, he's an indie horror film maker. I mean, this is just right up our alley here. Go ahead, pick his brain from a director's point of view there.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, how did you, what was your first project? Did you start with short films, or did you just go into doing feature films, or?
No, I started kind of with a short, and actually, believe it or not, it was a Texas Chainsaw Massacre one, which, you know, at the time I thought, you know, again, because the ideas were still spinning, and eventually just enough people told me to go ahead and try to make something. But the script was still a very long script. It was still close to 100 pages. And I knew I wouldn't be able to film that movie. So I essentially condensed it down to 25 pages or something like that, and decided to make it with, you know, I had $1,500 saved up. So I made the film ended up being around 30 minutes, and, you know, made a 30 minute film for $1,500. And It was a learning experience.
Hell yeah.
That's for sure. Oh, my old man, that was that ever a learning experience. But, you know, it's definitely not something I look back and say, wow, that was amazing. But at the same time, I can look at that and say, boy, there were some things we did in that were kind of cool.
Exactly. You know, me and Jackamuggy have talked about this. And, you know, I mean, should a young first time, you know, filmmakers on an extremely tight budget, you know, start out with something, you know, like a short. I see, looking over your IMDb, you have done plenty of them. There's plenty of them, you know, credited to you in some way, shape, or form, writing, directing, producing, composing, because you're also you've also been a musician as well. You can throw that in whenever. but I mean, that's probably the best way to get your feet wet. Get whatever kind of equipment that you have available to you that you're comfortable with, and take and get out there and film something. Is that kind of what, you know, you did? What role did you play in that short?
I was director, writer, and composer. And yeah, it was just enough people convinced me that I should just do it is what it boiled down to. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of money. So it was about, you know, well, how can I make it for this amount of money and still make it? So it was about condensing the script into to a point where, you know, I don't want to say I was a great screenwriter at that time, because I certainly was. And I still don't even consider myself a great screenwriter. But, you know, I've had a little bit of notice as of late. But you know, I had to find a way to condense a 98 page screenplay down to 25, and
wow,
I did. Yeah. I had to take a lot of characters out, and that's always kind of the first thing you look at: what characters am I going to take out, and how many locations am I going to have, and you know, ultimately, I wish I had done it better, but at the same time, it was a first film. It was a first film, and there's definitely stuff in there that I can be proud of. You know, there was definitely stuff in there I can be proud of. In fact, when we made our teaser trailer, I reused a couple of shots from that movie that we found. I think some of them were actually on the cutting. Some of the shots we used were on the cutting room floor that I thought, wow, that looks good. It'll fit in this. Put it in there because it still worked. So we did that. But at the same time, you know, I'm not going to look at that film and say, wow, that was a masterpiece.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, your first film, you know, and
but I can
all
still get a kick out of it.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I can still watch it and get a kick out of it, you know.
Yeah, a learning experience, like you said, I think, first and foremost. You probably learned a lot of, you know, things, a lot of tricks of the trade just in that very, you know, first go at it. That's awesome. James, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, special effects. Do you prefer, you know, mostly practical effects, or do you go with CG, a mix of both? Or
I've never used any CG myself. I worked on one film as a PA, so that's like the bottom of the barrel, like just helping out on set. That did have some CG in it. Again, the CG is done in post-production, but
right.
I've never directed a film myself that had any VFX in it. It was all SFX, special effects, practical.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's just me myself, though. I like practical. But I do understand that there are some things you probably have to do CG for.
Right.
So, yeah. But I hope I can avoid them if I can.
Exactly.
I totally understand that.
Yeah, and we've had, you know, some other directors and just plain special effects, you know, guys on. And some of them have said, if, you know, you can take and mix the two, in a you know, kind of proportion, like not too much of one or the, you know, I mean, then you can work. But for the most part, I'd probably have to say almost 100%, if not 99% of all the guests that we've had that's in the movie industry and in the filmmaking industry prefer special effects over CG. But like you said, Steve, there are certain things that's going to be probably even to the point of cost efficient. You know, I mean, maybe it's more cost effective to, you know, put a little CG in there versus having to spend all the time and the money in a elaborate special effects. If that isn't, you know, something you have at your disposal, time and money.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Yeah.
What? But, go ahead.
We should be able to make this film with all practical effects.
Now that was going to bring me to my next question, because it was talked about in one of the other shows that you have been on about how little blood was, you know, in the first Texas Chainsaw movie. I mean, you hear that, you know, Chainsaw Massacre. It doesn't matter where, but you hear Chainsaw and Massacre, and I think your mind's already assuming, oh, this is going to be a bloodbath on the silver screen, you know, and that wasn't the case really at all. And are you taking that same route with your fan film where you're going to kind of leave it, you know, to the person to imagine what's happening and not have to have the on-screen?
To an extent, getting into that a little bit, I mean, one thing I still hear to this day from a lot of people, even though we know that the original doesn't have a lot of blood in it other than maybe the ending, you know, Sally's really covered in blood. That was the majority of the blood in that movie. But the audience thinks they saw a lot of blood, especially when the movie first came out. They thought they saw a lot of blood. They thought it was a bloodshed. People walked out of that movie saying that was just a gore fest.
Yeah,
it really isn't. Right. I still want to do that to an extent. It's going to be subtle, but I think my goal is to make people think they see more blood than there actually is. And I think we capture that with our teaser trailer, because I hear a lot of people say it looks like they're bringing out the buckets of blood with this movie. It looks like it's going to be a blood fest, and sure there will be. There's more kills in our film, so there's going to be more blood. I think that's probably going to go kind of hand in hand a little bit. But at the same time, I want the audience to think they saw more than they actually did, because we didn't really have a lot of blood when we filmed that stuff in the trailer. There was really hardly any that we actually really worked with.
I think it's, you know, when you have these, you know, the kill scenes or whatnot, I think... Like one scene that will always stick out in my head in the first Texas Chainsaw is when I believe it was his name was Kirk, as a matter of fact, when he gets hit with little sledge, the little things, his feet twitching, his whole body twitching, that right there sent chills up my spine. That was absolutely horrifying. You didn't have to see the actual sledge go into the head and blood and all that. It was the little things like feet twitching.
Yeah. It's very powerful. Little things like that. So powerful. There was blood on him during that. You could see it kind of running down his chest, but if you took that away, do you think it would still be less powerful? I don't know.
What the feet or the blood?
If you took the blood away, let's say you took the blood away and the feet were still twitching, do you think it would be really that much less effective? I don't think it would. I think it would still be just as effective.
I don't think it would change one bit, because to me, the whole foot twitching and the body kind of convulsing because you just had massive trauma to the dome, that was more powerful to me than any blood. Jackalmonkey, go ahead. I think you were trying to jump in there.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And yeah, what Steve was saying a minute ago, like basically trick the audience into making them think that they saw more blood. That's absolutely fucking brilliant. Like, I love that. And like, after you said that, it was like a light bulb. I'm like, he's right. They totally did. They made me feel like I felt dirty after watching the first, you know, the first time I ever saw it, you know, like I felt like I needed to wash my eyes, but it's one of those movies where it's just so fucking intense, and you feel like you're there. You know what I mean? Like, Yeah. Like I'm really, really digging these ideas I'm getting now, man. These, yeah, that's really badass there, man. I really like that. I like that a lot.
We have the teaser trailer, that the one that I sent you, Steve, that I was going to show here, and then we can talk about that, because as it's been said with this trailer, it does kind of have a gritty kind of feel to it, like the first one. Let's take a look at this, and we'll come back and talk. This is the teaser trailer for the Sawyer Massacre.
Hey, I'm Joe Bob Briggs.
Whoops, sorry, wrong one. That's a good one too. This one is just a little bit long. We're gonna play that one probably towards the end. I just had him in the wrong order. Here we go.
Is this really the place?
Come on, Jimmy. It'll be fun.
Something's off here.
Bob, stay out of there!
We're all crazy. Everybody.
Shut it up!
You made it look like it was going to be a freaking bloodbath. I mean, towards the end, I mean, you see Leatherface, his apron's covered. You see whoever's hand with puddles of blood. I mean, it's just all over. But yet you're not really going that route. Great.
I mean, all that was very, very, it was done with very little blood. We didn't really have very much, you know. Mm-hmm. Even there's a quick shot of the chainsaw, and you see blood splattering from the chainsaw. Mm-hmm. That was just a little bit of fake blood in a coffee. It was in a coffee can, and we had the chainsaw cut through the coffee can and through the top of it, because it's plastic, easy to cut through. And it just, right, the way it's squirted up, there's very little blood actually used for that shot, but because of the way the chainsaw hit it, I guess it just made it look like it's so much more than it really was, you know.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, that's what making a movie really is, isn't it? I mean, you're kind of magicians. You're making what you call movie magic. You're doing these little things, tricking, you know, the audience into thinking, okay, I'm using gallons and gallons of blood when it's actually a coffee can with a little bit in it to make it look like you're using tons.
Maybe half
tons.
A liter, you know.
And be half a liter, exactly. Or like you were saying, and I have to second what Jackal Monkey was saying. That is a pretty fucking, you know, brilliant way to make a movie, not, you know, throw it out there, mm-hmm, right in your face. Yeah. You know, I mean, let you know that I think it kind of adds to the movie watching experience, you know.
It's like off screen kills, man. Like, you don't have to fucking show them everything, you know, like, right, leave a little bit for the viewer's imagination.
Mm-hmm. Well, there'll definitely be off screen kills, and we have so many kills that some of them have to be off screen a little bit, you know, but yeah, there will be. But I hope that for some of the off screen kills, my goal is to make people think that they actually did see the kills when they actually didn't. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
No, yeah, there'll be no blood for those. We won't use any blood for those off screen kills, but will the audience think that we did, you know? So hopefully that works. And
exactly. And I think
I love that little, I don't know if it was supposed to be, but it seemed like there was a little Evil Dead nod there. I like that a lot.
Where was that? I didn't intentionally.
Sound like she shut it off when she was screaming that in the trailer.
when she screamed, what, sorry?
Shut it off. That's what it sounded like, anyways. It reminded me of like the tape player on Evil Dead.
Oh. I don't think anybody says shut it off at any point. Trying to remember now.
It's just weird text in the ears.
Could be. I don't know. Well, most of the actors are from Texas. So
there you go. There you go. And I wanted to go back and make it.
I'm fucking excited for this one, man.
No, I am too. I wanted to make a quick note about the whole thinking that you saw a bloodbath and how you really didn't. And going back to, like you said, Sally at the end is covered in blood. You don't really see how she got covered in blood, to my knowledge. You see her, you know, she gets hit in the head a couple times, but other than that, I mean, you think you saw people slaughtered all around her, and you really didn't. And I think the most, you know, blood you probably saw at one time was when Leatherface, the chainsaw fell on his leg. I mean, you saw a little bit of meat there. I mean, that might be the most you've seen in one shot. Just off the top of my head, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what it seemed like to me anyway. Do you have a favorite fan film that's been out, Steve?
Texas Chainsaw or any
Any of them. You see one that you're like, wow, that was done really well, one that really stands out to you. It doesn't matter whether it's Texas Chainsaw or any of them.
Probably Never Hike Alone, even though I'm not the biggest Friday the 13th fan. I'll admittedly say that. I know it's blasphemic to say you're not a big fan of Friday the 13th.
I'm not either.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Good. At least I'm not alone. Jason just never really did a lot for me, you know, as a character. I never found him very intimidating. But the way they shot that film and kind of hid Jason a little bit in the early they built up to him, and it was a very, very different story. I like the idea it's from this vlogger's point of view while he's, you know, doing hiking, extreme hiking for his viewers. That was a very different angle. You'd never seen that before in a Friday the 13th, and I just thought, man, they did such a fantastic job making that film. Obviously they had money behind it, but to give us a different story, to keep Jason in the shadows a little bit rather than, you know, he's always kind of in your face. And it's like, once you see Jason, you've seen Jason.
Sure.
And there's not much mystique to him anymore. So, I mean, the way that that one was shot, I think it's probably my number one fan film at this point. Number one Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan film would have to be Last Roundup Rolling Grill. It was shot on a very low budget. Has such a gritty feel to it, like the original. And it just, I don't know, it's done very, very well. So, I mean, I got to give props to that film as well. But other than that, I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre hasn't had a lot of quality fan films come out. So, I mean, I give them props because, man, they had a shoestring budget. They were able to capture that gritty feel of the original. And did it, you know, ultimately they have a pretty, pretty cool little film. And I hope there's going to be more. I hope I hope my film will inspire more people to do Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan films, because I think we need more. I do.
I agree. Yeah. Kind of level out the playing field. As we said, you know, the fan film scene is saturated. It seems like with 90% Friday the 13th. Like I said, you're going to see a Halloween one thrown in there here and there, but not a whole lot from any of the other franchises. Go ahead, Jackamonkey.
I was going to say, I've actually been kicking around the idea of doing a Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan film, but have it revolve around Grandpa set in the Great Depression.
That's somebody had that idea a while back, and they even made a concept trailer, but they never made the film. I'm not sure what happened with that, because it was actually a very professionally shot trailer. it was maybe too professional looking. Maybe that was their what when it went against them, is that that it looked too polished for a Texas Chainsaw Massacre type of feel.
Yeah,
there was a little bit of acting in it that wasn't the best either. But you know, it did get a lot of praise though on YouTube. A lot of people were like wanting this movie. So what was that one called? I'm trying to remember. It'll come to me. It was about Grandpa though, a younger version of Grandpa. Maybe one aspect another aspect I didn't like of that trailer is that, well, Leatherface was a kid in that he was like a 10-year-old kid and Grandpa was like 50. So the time didn't, you know, if Grandpa's supposed to be like 120 in the original, you know, that would make Leatherface 80 in the original, somewhere around there. These kinds of things kind of, they're not the best, but you know, the timelines are never usually the best when it comes to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was an interesting concept.
Speaking of concept, where, without, I guess, giving any spoilers, what can you tell us about, the concept behind your fan film? I know you don't like, the term prequel because it implies an origin story. See, I've done my homework. I've heard you say that on numerous shows. So we won't use the word prequel, but when is your movie set? What time can you give us as much as you can without, you know, of course, giving any spoilers?
I think that first promo you were about to put up and changed actually says the exact date that our film takes place, June 30th, 1965.
So eight years
before the original.
Okay.
I chose June 30th just because that's my birthday. I chose 1965 though, because that was a pretty significant year when it came to the social climate in the US. It was, things had kind of drastically changed at that point. You know, you've got the Vietnam War was, you know, the first big schwack of U.S. troops went to Vietnam. There were some major disasters that happened. Can't remember the names of them, but it was something. I looked up a lot of stuff, and it was a time where, you know, a lot of the dirty things from the, you know, the U.S. government was sort of coming to light at that point. It was because before then it was all kind of, you know, you look at the 50s and everything is just great in people's minds. We don't know what's happening behind, you know, the doors of the government and all that kind of stuff, but the common people think that everything is just wonderful in the US, and that, you know, the future holds all this wonderful stuff because we won World War II and you know, so we're going to be rewarded for all the government is going to reward us rather than anything bad happen. And, you know, by the mid 60s, that ugliness started coming out. And I think by the time the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out, that ugliness was in full force. You know, you got Watergate and all, you know, so this is kind of to emphasize the beginning of horror in the US.
I've seen a lot of directors, the likes of John Carpenter, Wes Craven. I don't know if Toby Hooper has taken and put it out there, but I'm pretty sure he has, that a lot of their films, especially George Romero. Yeah, he has as well taken and made movies that do have kind of a little insight to what's going on in that particular time. Especially John Carpenter just comes to mind because I'm a Halloween guy. I love Michael Myers, that whole era. And it just, but Carpenter said that, you know, that was a really weird time in the U.S. in the mid 70s and, you know, going into the late 70s where he was making this film and that kind of just went along with it. I mean, you seem to agree with that as well, going by what you just said, I'm assuming. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And at the same time, you know, I wanted to draw parallels to today's to think, you know, there's a lot happening today, and it's not very hard to to make those parallels when you look at all the misery that's happening in our world right now. But I think that's good for my film because it makes it more relevant to, because, you know, if it was just focusing on the misery of back then, a lot of the audience wouldn't get that. So it's important that there are some parallels so that, you know, the audience can identify. But at the same time, this isn't a movie about COVID. You know, it's not a movie.
No, right.
It, you know, at the same time, I have to make sure it feels like it's set in that time period, and it just needs to feel relevant to today.
How difficult is that? You alluded to it again on, you know, other shows that you have been on, but how difficult is it to, when you're doing a timepiece like that, where, you know, an era piece where everything is in a certain, you know, your clothes have to match that time, you know, vehicles you had mentioned, everything has to, you know, revolve. I mean, you had made a mention, I think, one of the Texas Chainsaws, where, you know, it was like that model chainsaw that was used, that was supposed to be, you know, way back when, wasn't it, you know, even out until the 90s or something. So how difficult is that? And are you struggling currently with that, with your film, The Sawyer Massacre?
Not really. I've managed to be fairly lucky in that regards. The vehicles were sort of the thing that
I could imagine
I was probably freaking out the most.
Right.
But one of the locations that we found, you know, when I found this location, he had an old car parked up front. So when I talked to this guy about using his location, I was asking him about his car. And he was like, oh, I have two old cars like that. And I know a bunch of, you could use them, and, you know, we won't charge anywhere near as much as what, you know, a typical car collector would charge you. But, you know, he's still going to rent them to us because, I mean, at the same time, you know, these are classic cars.
Sure.
But at the same time, I'm not going to be paying thousands of, I'll be paying hundreds of dollars instead of thousands of dollars is essentially what that's working out to.
Right.
So, I mean, I got pretty lucky there that I'm going to have all the necessary vehicles that I will need, you know, and it's not going to be as difficult as I thought it would be. Costumes is another thing, but I've been given a lot of tips on how to get away with the costume design, and it's, I think we'll have that pretty covered. Props, we've managed to secure a lot of old antique props from way back when. So I think that area of the film is pretty well covered now, I'm happy to say. That's because awesome. There was a time where I was a little bit worried about it. You know, I was trying to make contact after contact, and, you know.
The car issue seems to would have been the most difficult. In my opinion, anyway, you know, the costumes and that you could, you know, fudge the costumes. I mean, that don't seem like it would be all that difficult to actually make something that you would see in that particular year.
Not too bad. And, you know, like places like thrift stores, like Value Village, end up having a lot of that stuff, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm not too worried about the costumes. We have to make sure we know somebody who can do hairstyles, right? So that's going to be kind of important, the hairstyles of that time period. But other than that, I think we're on par. We're going to be on par with what we need as far as all that goes. So we're excited about it. That's for sure.
I'll throw this in there, right there. Like, and that has me even more excited. Like, I mean, and for anybody that was even, you know, maybe, oh, well, you know, on the fence about this, that right there, the fact that you paid that much attention to the fucking chainsaw in the remake that wasn't even happening. That right there, like, I'm already like, oh, yeah, give this man the reins. Let him fucking do this.
And I paid enough attention to, since you bring that up, I paid enough attention to do the research to know that the chainsaw used in the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out in 1970. So our film predates that chainsaw. So we went back and got an older chainsaw from the 1950s. So I went online looking for 1950s chainsaws, and I came across this one. I thought to myself, I want to see Leatherface with this chainsaw. And that's it was tough to find one that runs. It was tough.
That was going to be my next question. I mean, with the automobiles, unless it is somebody who is, you know, vintage car collector that would rent it to you for thousands of dollars, you know. But
my chainsaw is like, it was like an 80 something and it don't fucking run. Like,
yeah.
Right. I mean, I in the 50s, holy shit.
So you were lucky enough to find one that will actually run to do what you need Leatherface to take and do with it.
I actually found two of them, believe it or not. Wow. But the one that was originally going to sell it to me, I had contacted two people. One of the guys didn't want to sell me his chainsaw. And he's like, I don't think I want to sell you the chainsaw. I love it that too much. But this other guy was like, sure, I'll sell it to you, you know, a couple $100. I'm like, sure. Sounds good.
Fucking sweet.
And I kept reaching out to him. How can I pay for this for you? Can I pay it through PayPal? Blah, blah, blah. All this kind of stuff. Can you get it shipped to, you know, our production coordinator's office and blah, blah, blah. He wasn't responding. He didn't respond for months. So finally I reached out to the other guy and said, any chance you could sell me that chainsaw? He's like, sure, I'll sell it. And so the other guy ended up selling me the chainsaw. And we made that transaction happen right away, and it's in the production coordinator's possession right now. It's a heavy bastard, though.
I keep telling
our Leatherface actor, Scotty Parkin, you better get yourself in shape because you got to lift this 45, 50-pound chainsaw over your head. I mean, they say it's 35 pounds, but my production coordinator seems to think it's heavier. She hasn't actually weighed it yet, though, so... Right. Just so you know, this is one heavy ass chainsaw.
You know, everything was heavier, you know, back then. Furniture, cars, just everything was heavier. Yeah. So then are you focusing on in your film, Steve? Are you going to be focusing on the family? As far as grandpa, the cook, the other retard, are you going to be focusing on that family that was, you know, kind of centered around in the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Is that what is happening here? Again, without you like spoiling anything, whatever you can tell us. I mean, maybe I'm diving too deep.
Well, I can tell you that all the members of that family are in this film.
Okay.
To some extent. Gotcha. I can also tell you, though, that there's not a single scene in the entire film where all of them are together at once. So it's almost to create a bit of mystique to each character. Like, you know, is this guy in on it? Or, you know, just so that we have a little bit of mystique. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that the member of the two members of the family that get the most focus are Grandpa and Leatherface. Those two get the more focus than any else. Grandpa hasn't lost the ability to speak, so he still speaks barely. It's, you know, hard for him to get words out, but he has but you get a lot of insight through him. And for those of you who don't know, I'll say it again. You probably heard me say this on other podcasts or whatever, but for our teaser trailer, we did get original Grandpa John Dugan to actually voice Grandpa in the teaser trailer. That's a pretty cool little thing. Yeah, that's a pretty cool little thing. So the first time you'll ever hear John Dugan speak as Grandpa is in our teaser trailer. And maybe the only time, I don't know. I'm still trying to get him to do it for the movie, but he has a little bit of a conflicting thing with that. So
no. So, all right, well then we'll just leave it at that. That it seems like it's, you know, the family member wise, it's going to be, you know, more centered around Leatherface and Grandpa. And we'll just leave it at that.
Family wise, I mean, ultimately this is the character, the, you know, your protagonist's, you know, story. It's their story rather than the story of the family. Again, that would go more along the lines of an origin story if we're exploring the family a little bit more. And I don't really like to demystify too much. You know, I want to give a little bit more, but at the same time, I hope with this, I'm hiding stuff that you would find out from the original. So if you watch this one and then watch the original, you'd be like, oh, that's that guy that would, you know, that sort of thing, that, you know, that you're given more from the original than you actually probably get from this.
Nice. Huh.
Interesting. Jackal Monkey, what do you got?
Not much. I mean, I'm ready to fucking see this motherfucker. I'm excited, man. Is the Indiegogo still going, right?
Yeah, the Indiegogo is gonna, I think we're gonna just leave it up at least until we start filming, because there's potential for us to raise more, obviously, and you know, we have enough to make the movie. But I'd like to raise more if we can get money for post-production rather than me edit the film myself. I'm not a bad editor, but I'm not a great editor either. I don't really have a massive computer storage for a feature film either. So I'd have to be, you know, editing it off these massive hard drives and stuff like that. So if I have budget for post-production, I have a really good editor in mind. So you know, hopefully we can raise enough money to do some good post.
Awesome. Awesome. What, my mind just went blank there.
That's all good.
Yeah. I mean, and that's so badass. Like you said, you got John Dugan. How fucking great is that? Like, I mean, and how did that come up? I mean, just as simple as you reaching out to him.
This is as simple as me reaching out to him. That's just how it went down. I said, how much would you charge if I asked you to do this for me? And, you know, I feel like, okay, I can do that. Let's do that. Let's do it. And I just figured it would be iconic to have him do that. And, you know, he was okay with that. Yeah. I hope you never know. He might be okay to do Grandpa once we have it filmed. He's not going to be on set no matter what. I know that, but we might get him to voice Grandpa. We'll see. I don't know. I never say never, but I don't like to let go of things if there's a chance.
Oh, exactly. Small chance.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah. But definitely hell, you won't have him physically playing Grandpa, unfortunately. We know that's not going to happen, but we might get him to voice him. We'll see.
Let's look a little beyond the Sawyer Massacre, and I don't know how far in the future that, you know, you have looked into, if you look beyond the Sawyer Massacre. I know you do have a lot of projects actually in pre-production and whatnot. Again, according to your IMDb, I'm assuming that's all, you know, up to date and legit. So
more or less, you know, at least the projects that are fully mine, some of them aren't fully mine. So I'm just like an executive producer or something like that or a producer of some kind on a couple of films. It just depends. But I do plan on doing more films after this. Obviously, I want to do more feature length films. That's just what, you know, I've done my fair of shorts. I don't mind doing shorts, but I think the narrative structure that I do when I write a screenplay is more well suited for feature length films. So, or at least some sort of longer film. It could be a long, I could do like 25, 30 minute shorts and I'll probably be okay. But, you know, I'd rather just stick to features, you know, I just rather stick to a feature length type of movie, even though they cost more money to do. But, you know, depending on what's needed, they can be a lot cheaper too. So, yeah.
Right.
Now, I mean, are you pretty much indie filmmaker? I mean, like, just that's how you're going to go? Is that how you're going to try and carry the rest of your career out? Sticking with the independent scene as far as filmmaking? Or would you go out? You know, I wouldn't say sell out, because every director or every, you know, in this would love to be, you know, set up like a John Carpenter. You know what I'm saying? Or, you know, the late Wes Craven or the late Toby Hooper. Everybody would love to have that prestige, You know, it just seems that a lot of first time, you know, filmmakers such as Jackal Monkey, you know, start out in the indie scene. It seems that that seems to help a lot of first timers. So, but are you going to try and like stick that and just, you know, live your career out in the indie scene?
I would like to, for sure. I mean, I just I think the difference between the indie scene and the Hollywood scene, if you want to call it that, is the creative control. I mean, not a lot of Hollywood directors have creative control.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No matter what film, like you think that, okay, this director wrote and directed the script. Well, they were probably hired by a studio to say, you need to do this, this, and this, and this, and this in your script.
Right.
Have all these checkpoints. You put those in your script and then you direct it, you know? So they have bullet points they have to go off of. They can't, I mean, it's not like the indie scene where you can just write a script and that's good.
Yeah.
And make that script. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because Hollywood's so concerned on what sells, right? They're always so concerned on what is selling, and it doesn't really matter, it doesn't really matter whether it suits the story or not, but if it has these certain things that sell, then, you know, then it gets greenlit.
in today's, you know, climate with this whole cancel culture, you know, thing, and everything's got to be, you know, PC. Yeah, a lot of the ideas.
How in the fuck?
I mean, go ahead.
How in the fuck can a group that grew up watching South Park be so fucking offended by everything? What the hell?
that's a true story, I guess. I mean
shit.
But it seems like, you know, if you don't, I mean, some of the indie lower budget films that I've seen, if they took that script as it played out on the movie, if they took that to, again, your big corporate Hollywood, you know, ish type people, it'd probably go from an hour and a half movie to a 30-minute short, because you'd have to take everything out because, oh, that'll offend this person. That'll offend that person, you know?
Terrifier is a prime example of that. I mean, there's no fucking way that Hollywood would have allowed Terrifier to be made.
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest shit. It might be the biggest indie horror movie that's ever came out, I think.
It might be. I don't know. I have to look at the numbers. I mean, the Blair Witch Project was at least. I don't know if that's still the case,
I think Blair Witch did surpass, I think, because at one time, Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween was the biggest independent film. When you talk about profit, you know, made on about $320,000+ and millions and millions and millions that it's made, and you know, merch and DVDs, everything's
toy.
So, but I do think that Blair Witch, I think that may have surpassed. I'm not positive, but I think so too. I think you're right, Steve. I want to throw this out here because we're right up against our hour mark here, just about 5 or so minutes. I need to ask you this. What director, we've talked a lot about different directors. What director influenced you or inspired you the most to go the route of directing films? What had the most impact on you? Like, you see what this guy's done or this woman's done, and you say, that's what I want to do, and hit you that hard.
By the way, we need more women directors.
I know, right? You don't have that many, do you?
I think we need more. I know they're out there. I think Hollywood's been giving them the shaft, unfortunately. But I know that we are starting to see more. But I mean, if I have to go from my past, it's gonna obviously there's gonna be more males to choose from. So I mean, I think the most influential director for me as a whole is Steven Spielberg. Because I mean, you look at everything he's done, everything is different. Everything, you know, there, you know, I mean, just start with Jaws. I mean, Jaws is one of my, is in my top five films of all time for sure.
Yes, and my mine as well. Mine as well.
Yeah. So I mean, he's done horror, he's done action, he's done comedy, he's done drama. He's you know,
nobody pigeonholed him into a particular genre.
Exactly. Right. He's, you know, obviously in his early days in Hollywood, he kind of had to follow a certain, but he definitely got to a point where he could you know, make the films he wanted to make. And so kudos to him. And I just love his directing style. I would like to say the same about George Lucas, but ultimately as a director, to me, his directing works better when he's an indie filmmaker, as opposed to, you know, like the big blockbuster Star Wars movies. I kind of think that the better Star Wars movies are the ones that he didn't direct. I think his writing was right for them, but the directing, not so much. Just my opinion, though. I still love. I was a big Star Wars fan. I got a Return of the Jedi poster on there.
Yeah, I was gonna say Return of the Jedi.
But if I'm going horror, it's definitely John Carpenter. John Carpenter has definitely been, you know, the types of movies he's made in the horror genre and outside of the horror genre. Not everything he's done is totally horror. So
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy that wanted to do, apparently he wanted to do Westerns.
Is what he grew up loving and on like a soundstage. He wanted to do like soundstage work versus like out in the field type work. He said he always, you know, he loved, you know, a lot of his influences were, you know, from, you know, the 40s and 50s and those directors. Yeah. I couldn't name them off, but they directed a lot of, you know, your older, you know, Westerns, which is what he loved to do.
Did he ever direct a Western?
I honestly don't think so. The closest he did was Precinct 13. Was it Precinct 13?
Yeah, Assault on Precinct 13.
It had a shootout. I don't know how close.
Yeah, it had a shootout. Yeah. I don't know if you still call it a Western, though.
I don't think you could, but it's about as close as I can think of.
But yeah, Sam Raimi beat it. Kind of funny. Yeah. It is kind of funny that he never did a Western when he really wanted to do Westerns. Even, you know, Westerns kind of came back a little bit in the early 2000s or a little, you know. But, you know, he couldn't do that early on because Westerns were out of style. You know,
and that's what he's made mention of numerous times. Like, hey, well, you know, Westerns were out and, you know, I needed to make money. So you go with what's hot and what's selling. And at that time, horror was selling, you know, horror was big.
It was a good time for it, for sure.
It really was in the 70s. Would you say, before we wrap it up, would you say that that would be your favorite genre or time of horror would be like 70s, 80s horror or just
70s for sure. 70s for sure.
Yeah.
70s and a little bit 60s. 80s, I know everybody loves the 80s, but I don't know. I think they're hit and miss in the 80s for me.
They really are. I do like
a lot of them, but yeah, but mostly 70s. Yeah. There you go.
I do like
some of them are all.
I like the older black and whites too, you know. So, you know, from the 50s and 60s, you know, some there's some good gems out there. Steve, thank you again. Now, people just go to Indiegogo. I'm gonna play the other little teasers at the end here. And I believe the one with Joe Bob Briggs, does that have the URL on that particular promo to go?
I think all of them have the Indiegogo URL. So
sweet. Yeah.
Click
go
on
over
that
there and there you go. Show some love, show some support, and let's get this fan film. The Sawyer Massacre, Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan film. We don't have enough of them, as we've mentioned. And this one looks absolutely awesome. Steve, hang on for a second. I'm going to put you in the back. Sure. Thank you again for your time this Sunday evening. And but I want to say bye to you off the air. So stick around for me real quick. Jackal Monkey, Man, I told you. I told you. It's just going to be a fountain of info. There's going to be a lot of things that we're going to be able to, get from, these indie horror filmmakers, just indie filmmakers, period. Tips, tricks of the trade and little things, man. It was a lot of fun. Had some people join in kind of late. Thomas, I guess, or Tomas. he said, ask what Steve wrote. Well, he is, I think, writer, producer, composer, director. New fan film coming out, which I'm going to play the little promo on our way out. The Sawyer Massacre. So, man, with that being said, thank you, sir. What are you chewing on? Can you even hear
that
me?
Goddamn fucking nicotine gum, man. Yeah. Nicotine. My fucking nicotine gum, man. I quit smoking, man. Fucking, one of my coworkers the other day at work, she was like, "What the fuck are you chewing on?" I was like, "Nicotine gum." She's like, "Oh, I see you over there. Fuck, I'm chomping on that shit."
Chewing all wacky.
Well, hey, fuck, I had to quit smoking. Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us. Of course, this will be up on our YouTube channel. You're just going to have to. We're almost to the little 100 subscribers. We're late at the YouTube game, but we're almost to the 100 subscribers, and then we can have a cool little URL, so get over there, subscribe, but it will be over there. I'll be passing the links out, the YouTube, and there'll be an audio version which you can catch on Spotify and Stitcher, and you will catch that audio over there at nightlivingdreads.com. And all of these links will be provided over there at the Facebook group. We have a page and a group. The group's where we have all the good medication. I'm just throwing that out there. So, all right, man. We're going to get the hell out of here. Thank you, guys. We'll be back next Sunday. Have a good week, Jack-o-monkey.
Hell yeah. You too, brother.
All right. Enjoy your gum, man.
Oh, yeah. I will.
Have a good week, guys.
Hey, I'm Joe Bob Briggs, and indie filmmaker Steve Merlo is making a feature-length Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan film called The Sawyer Massacre. So make sure to check out his Indiegogo campaign and teaser trailer to help him get his production to Texas, where it should be.
People around here used to talk about the old man in that house and the terrible things he did. Some would say the whole family was nuts. Just rooms. That's all.
Well, that house gives me the creeps.
We're all crazy. Everybody.